Let me say a few words after thanking everyone for joining me of introduction. I was asked to give a series that begins today. I think it'll be either three Sundays in a row, maybe four Sundays in a row until sometime towards the end of August, and Rabbi Adler will be teaching as usual after that on tshuvas, on responsa literature. And what we're going to try to do is hone in on landmark tshuvas. What I mean by landmark tshuvas is that sometimes a question comes up and it's really never been addressed, at least not in that form, in the history of the Jewish people. And the posek makes a heroic revolution of sorts, some new insight, makes an equation to some sugya and shas, which intuitively you would never think is relevant. And based on that analogy, he comes up with a pretty sensational answer to a question. And that tshuva, that answer that he gives, is going to have an impact on Jewish history. Now, I was trying to organize a curriculum for these four times that we'll get together, and I decided to dedicate the first of the four lectures to family, anything that's relevant to the family, and show how issues relevant to the family have been addressed by poskim. And my goal is to find one particular posek somewhere in Jewish history that took on the issue head on and came up with a pretty radical answer that's going to have an impact on Jewish history. Now, yeah, you have to keep in mind that the principle of psak is koach dehetera adif. What that means is that the power of finding a heter is more superior, it's more important than... It's always easy to say, well, you ask me a question, we have a phrase in Yiddish, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, as mefrekt ha-shaila is treif. So it's very easy to say everything is treif. You know, I don't have to be a great scholar to say that. The real challenge of a scholar and a posek, and especially when it's a time of need, is to come up with a kula, some sort of a heter to permit something that... It would be very easy for the posek to just hide behind, it's usur, you know. And it does seem, in almost all of these cases, that initially it's going to be usur, it's going to be prohibited. But how can the posek come up with a new insight, and based on this revolution, permit something that, on the face of it, would have been prohibited? Now, what I want to do again as part of my introduction is just to mention a few tshuvas. We're not going into detail until each week as we go by, but to give you a sense of what I have in mind. Back at the time of the Rambam, which is 1,000 years ago, the issue was Jews who accepted, at least externally, other religions under the force of persecution. And the Rambam penned a very, very important tshuva called Igeres Hashmad. And to this day, the Yemenite community will mention the Rambam, at least parts of the Yemenite community, in their Kaddish, because they have such awe and respect for the Rambam because of that position that the Rambam took. I'll give you another example. There's an awesome tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef, again I'm fast-forwarding by 9 centuries here, on the issue of the Ethiopian Jews. What's their status? So that would be a landmark tshuva that has a tremendous impact on Jewish history. Here's another issue that came up at the time of Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is called Hazra'a Malachutit, artificial insemination, in which all the poskim assume that that's absolutely prohibited because it was a radical new idea of how to procreate. And Rav Moshe came up with a landmark tshuva, which I hope we'll get a chance to study. In our time, starting with the Chafetz Chaim, the issue of Talmud Torah for women, which again, to you and I today, it seems so obvious. In Yiddish, we'd say it's upgered, without a shadow of a doubt, that women could study Torah on the highest level. That wasn't so simple. And we needed one of these heroic tshuvas. Another area that I'd like to cover is Kiddush Hashem. Under what circumstances is a Jew called upon to give up his life? Tosis in Masechta Gittin records a case of 400 girls who jumped into and committed suicide rather than be defiled. And the question that came up many, many centuries later at the time of the Holocaust was, under what situations is there an obligation of Kiddush Hashem? Some of the landmark tshuvas were penned 1,000 years before the Shoah, especially the Maharam Rutenberg, and hopefully we'll cover that. Other issues, like for example, what's called Heter Iska. Here in Israel, you go to a bank and you deposit money. You never even blink about the fact that you're going to get ribis, you're going to get interest. That's a violation of a number of lavim d'oraisa. And way back when, they came up with something called a Heter Iska, and it's time it was revolutionary. Another example, and this is dates back about 100 years ago or more to Rav Kook, at the time of Palestine, the issue of, can we work the land during Shemitah? And he came up with something called a Heter Mechira. And again, it had a tremendous ripple effect on Jewish history. Another issue I'd like to cover, especially in the context of our first Roman numeral number one, which is family law, is civil marriage. What's the status of civil marriage? And here we have a landmark tshuva of Rav Henkin, Zichron Levracha, who was the final posek in America, say 60, 70 years ago, in which he claims that civil marriage has to be understood in a new light, based on his analysis of a Gemara in Kiddushin. Another issue, how do we treat non-religious Jews? Well, there's a landmark tshuva of the Chazon Ish, in which he spins it all the way around about our relationship to a non-religious Jew. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a landmark tshuva about inviting non-religious Jews to Shabbos, knowing that they're going to come by driving on Shabbos, they're going to be Chal Shabbos. Another issue is, how do we relate to terrorism? Is terrorism considered a molchemes mitzvah? It has tremendous repercussions. Rav Avad Yosef has a landmark tshuva on that. Electricity. What is the status of electricity? Again, a breakthrough tshuva of the Marsh Dam, who is in a city in Poland called Berzhan, the Berzhan Rav. And afterwards came many other poskim who stood on the shoulders of that breakthrough tshuva. The issue of Eretz Yisrael. Is there a mitzvah to live in Israel today? And over the course of centuries, many assume, like a certain Tosus at the end of a Sefer Ksuvos in the name of Chaim Cohen, that there's no mitzvah today of living in Eretz Yisrael, until in the Hasidic world, the Avnei Nezer, the Sokhachov Rebbe, came up with a landmark tshuva. Another issue is aguna, a woman whose husband is lost, let's say out at sea, and he hasn't come back, a landmark tshuva from Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and all the tshuvas written subsequently on this issue of aguna, including the tshuvas about 9/11, there were 10 agunas whose bodies, their husbands, we didn't find, all based on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, a brand new understanding of rov and two rovs and how that works. The question of eruv, I don't know if you know the issue in Manhattan, for example. But the issue of an Erev in Manhattan really dates back to the city of Paris before the war, and it was the Chazon Ish who came up with a brilliant revolutionary idea about Erevin in order to justify the Erev. The question of buying milk from non-Jewish sources. When I was a kid, it was called Elmhurst milk, but whatever company you have. And Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a landmark tshuva on the issue and reinterpreted a whole sugya of what it means to have supervision over milking a cow. These and a million other issues came before the Jewish people, and they were referred to the giants of their generation. And in many cases, the poskim would come up with a new revolution, as I call it, very heroic. It was a position that would no doubt generate a lot of opposition. Rav Moshe Feinstein, people don't know this, but in his lifetime he faced a tremendous opposition, both on the issue of Chol HaVakum and on the issue, especially on the issue of artificial insemination, and the Satmar Hasidim went wild, and it's a whole polemics about this. But Rav Moshe stuck to his guns, and he had, and to this day in fertility treatments in Orthodox circles, we rely on his breakthrough. I would like to begin with family. And here are the issues that I want to address. Two major issues that relate to the prohibition of yichud, which means that a man and a woman, if there's an erva relationship, they're not allowed to have a relationship, and they find themselves in a private place. So we're talking about privacy. That's the key of understanding yichud. The page that I gave you has on it a tshuva from the Radbaz. This tshuva dates 5 centuries ago, in the city of Cairo in Egypt, Rabbi David Ibn Zimra was the outstanding posek. He was a contemporary of the Beit Yosef. Now, before we read this tshuva inside, or at least emphasize the parts, there are other lines there that I was able to underline for you. Under what conditions are there leniencies to permit yichud? And the most important principle that we have to understand is called Pesach Pasuach L'Rishus HaRabim, which means that anyone can come in at any time. The door is unlocked. Maybe, according to some poskim, it has to be open or at least ajar. And that would interfere with privacy. If that interferes with privacy, then there's no yichud. So again, we're going to start with the assumption that in a private place, yichud is prohibited. Whether it's d'oraisa, d'rabbanan, are we talking about a biblical prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition? That would require a long, long study. That's not for us now. Let me put the Radbaz into historical context. The Radbaz was addressing a situation that arose in Egypt in which Orthodox Jewish women, in order to support their family, were working with non-Jewish men. And often, that would require a certain element of privacy. If we fast forward 5 centuries into contemporary life, this becomes relevant in women who work in offices. I had a student of mine who she worked for the government in Washington, D.C., and if she would stay overtime, she would get paid, I don't know if it was 1.5 or 200% of her salary. But the issue was that her employer, who is a non-Jewish man, was there putting in extra hours. So she had a real serious yichud problem. But again, I don't even have to put this into the 20th or 21st century. Just think of Egypt back in the 16th century. And the Rabbanim, the Chachamim there, were up in arms. How can we allow this situation of women, Jewish women, working out there in the workplace amongst non-Jewish men? This is a violation of the Isur Yichud. And I want to read to you a paragraph before we read the Radbaz, just so you appreciate the radical nature of the Radbaz. What was the assumption on the part of the poskim before the Radbaz? Okay, so this is pre-Radbaz. Now, I published an article on this topic many, many years ago. Unfortunately, my copy of the, it's called the RJJ Journal, is not accessible to me, but I do have a photocopy here. It's not in great shape, but I'm able to at least read it. So I want to read to you a paragraph here that describes the situation before the Radbaz. What was the opinion and what were the rabbis writing when they were facing what was going on in their time? So the first tshuva on this issue was written in the early 1600s by the Bet Moshe. The Bet Moshe is quoted by other poskim, and he in turn quotes a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah establishes that not only is there an Isur Yichud between a Jewish man and a Jewish woman, but even between a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man.
Reverse.
And the reverse as well. But we're going to focus now for a moment on this case of a Jewish woman with a non-Jewish man. And the Gemara tells us, in the name of Rav Idi, This is Gemara in Avodah Zarah. I'll tell you exactly what daf it's on in a second. Hopefully I'll find it. In any event, he says the following, that the only exception to this rule, the only time a woman, a Jewish woman, is permitted to have yichud with a non-Jewish man is in a case of an isha chashuva. Now, exactly the literal translation of an isha chashuva is an important woman. But the way Rashi interprets it, it's a woman who has close connection, political connection, in government. You know, she has that status of, and therefore the goyim have a natural tendency of being afraid. Is this not working?
No.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
No, it's fine.
The goyim have a natural tendency of avoiding any relationship with this woman because of the fear of legal consequences, because she is up there with the higher echelons of government. Now, the Beit Moshe says that it's got to be very, very extenuating circumstances to allow yichud, because as he addressed it, which women in our society are up there, you know, in the higher echelons of government? Therefore, he and other poskim write, we would say in Yiddish, Shrei Chai V'Kaya, you know, they yell and scream against this thing that's going on. Fine. Now we get to Rabbi David Ibn Zimra, and that's the tshuva that I have photocopied for you here.
What's the chashash?
Good question. It's one of two possibilities. It's either rape or it might be seduction. Let's assume at the first stage it's rape, and then we'll introduce the Radbaz. And since the legal consequences of rape in this case are so severe because of her high status, therefore we're not afraid. That's the way the Beit Moshe and the Shulchan Aruch also seems to assume the same. Okay, fine. Now, enter stage Radbaz. Now, what I want to show you about the Radbaz is that he's not willing to allow this. My emphasis here on the Radbaz is because of the impact that his tshuva had in Jewish history for the next five centuries and beyond. In terms of the actual case of a Jewish woman being alone with a non-Jewish man in the working place, he is on board. It's prohibited. He's not going to outlaw it. I'm sorry, he's not going to permit it. And that's what you'll see at the beginning of the tshuva. He says, Sha'alta al mashen nagu b'mitzrayim, on the top line. I'll translate this. Shalhochos hanoshim lasas b'lochu beis akum v'yomdo sham gimel odalid yomim v'leilos. They actually sleep over there. And, you know, there's a certain chashash over here, that the suspicion of something not kosher v'yosher going on. And therefore his tshuva, but this is not the part of the tshuva I'm emphasizing. I'm only emphasizing this to show you how the history of tshuvas has an impact. Yesh b'maaseh zeh pritzus gadol. He says that this is not something that we could be happy about. This is pritzut. This is improper, immodest behavior. And he quotes all the other poskim that agree that this you know, we have to put a stop to this and so forth and so on. But at some point in the tshuva, he emphasizes that these women are supporting their families, and therefore we have to find some sort of a leniency. He says he's not going to allow this to go on, but on the other hand, if it is going on, we're not going to assume that she, you know, by having this private situation has violated the prohibition of yichud, which has tremendous repercussions within the context of marriage. So again, he's not going to endorse this kind of behavior, and that's important for us as we go along, but yet he's going to come up with some sort of a, again, in inverted commas, a justification, b'di'evah, you know, post facto, that this is not a violation of yichud. And in the lines that I underlined, he comes up with two pieces of logic. And he says the following. Hani vahani, meaning the ladies who are working and their employers, be'avidatayu tarit. So if you're looking at the tshuva in the page that I gave you, it's four lines up before the end of the tshuva, and you want to focus on those two words, be'avidatayu tarit, which literally translates that they're preoccupied with their work. And he says the following, V'afal gav detam ze levado, that this logic in and of itself, if that's all I had to base my case on, lo yaspik, that would not be enough to in any way ameliorate the violation of Yichud. Mikomakom, nevertheless, havi snifim lahanach taimi diliel. Okay, so let me take a few moments of talking about the word sniff in singular and snifim in plural. Because again, in the history of tshuvas, the word sniff is like extremely important. And let me explain to you the following. In Lagdus, when we learn Torah, when we learn Halacha, our mathematical premise is that 0 plus 0 equals 0. Which means that a half and a half, if each thing is nothing, in and of itself, it's 0 plus 0. When you get to Psak Halacha, however, there's a whole new world out there. And that's called snifim. Snifim means that we have logical arguments, which each one of which is not successful, will not carry you over the hump. But when you put them all together, and you put them in a cholent, then we can come up with a leniency if necessary. That's called snifim. Just on the side, you should know that the great Rosh Yeshivas, like my Rosh Yeshiva of Soloveitchik, avoided psak halacha to the large extent. Only when they really had to. They left that for the poskim, because in their world of Torah, it's like black or white. Either it's mutter or it's asur. You can't come up with snifim and tell me, well, if I only had this reason alone, that wouldn't have been enough. If I had this reason alone, but I combine them together, and all of a sudden, I come up with a license and a permission. So what happens here is that the Radbaz in the first part of this tshuva, which we didn't read inside, but I'll just highlight for you, he says, well, you know what, the women are in an area where somebody might show up, so maybe it's called Pesach Pasul Shiram, but on the other hand, at night, you know, who's going to show up? Then he goes on to say, but maybe her husband is somewhere within the city limits, so maybe he can come, but that's not true because they're outside the city limits. So he has a bunch of logical arguments, none of which are enough to carry him over and create a license. But now he says, I have one logical argument, which is called Davadotayu Tarid, and they're so preoccupied with their work that there's no suspicion that there'll be a sexual relationship here, that therefore I can come up with a sniff. And he says, if I take this sniff as one calculation and I combine it with the other two, then maybe we could come up with a license. But again, he emphasizes that in and of itself, by the Tayyut Torah would not be enough. Now, where does the Radbaz get this from? And to answer this question, I'm answering this question because I want to show you how revolutionary this was. These two words, Bavad Tayyut Torah, I believe the Radbaz borrowed from a sugya that has nothing to do with Yichud whatsoever. This is a pure creative analogy of the Radbaz. So we're going to see how much this analogy is going to have an impact on Jewish history for five centuries and beyond. So you're following me. The Radbaz is coming up with Avodatayu Torid, and he's going to borrow it from some other context, make an analogy that no one ever did before. That's what Psak Halach is all about, in its glory, you know, when it reaches its highest level. So I did a word search, so to speak, for Avodatayu Torah, and I found it in Avodah Zorah Daf Chof. What happens in Avodah Zorah Daf Chof? We're talking about animal breeders. Now, when you breed an animal, a male and a female, then very often what you have to do is actually, you have to, it's called Kimchol Bishvofaris, what's the word am I looking for? It's a euphemism. Yeah, it's like a euphemism for taking the male organ and actually putting it into the female organ's body. So the Gemara says the following: we're not allowed to see certain things because they create what's called hirur, you know, bad thoughts in our mind. So, for example, the Gemara says, "Lo yistakel odu beisha na." A man is not, you know, gaze at a woman, whether she's married or not married. And if she's married, it's an absolute iser. You're not allowed to even look at a woman's clothing if they're, you know, colored clothing and so forth and so on. Then the Gemara goes on and say, we're not allowed to watch animals as they are breeding. Because that also, the Gemara says, could bring us to hirhur. So the Gemara asks the following question. If that be the case, if you can't watch animals breed, so then how am I allowed to breed animals? Now, apparently this was an occupation that was quite common amongst Orthodox Jews, that they would breed animals and they would sell the produce on the market, the reproduction. Or, for example, the Gemara asked, what about a koves? A koves is a dry cleaner, I guess you'd say, or somebody who gets his money by washing garments, and very often he's given clothing that's colored, and it's female garments. Why don't we have a problem over here? So the Gemara says the following: Had Amar Rabbi Yehuda min bimino mutar lahachnis kimchol bishvofares. That if he has a male animal and a female animal, again, there's certain conditions that have to be met, he's allowed to create this relationship, right? Hakom istakel, he certainly has to see what he's doing over here. Maybe he'll come to the wrong thoughts. So the Gemara answers, Bavidetayu Torah, exactly the same two words that the Radbaz here. So what I'm doing is I'm adding a footnote to the Radbaz. And that footnote doesn't exist in the Chumash of the Radbaz. The Avodatayu Torin, Ayin Avodazor Daf Chaf Amid Beis. The only occasion where the Gemara uses those two words, that if you're involved and preoccupied with making money, because that's your business, and therefore you're not going to be distracted by other thoughts because your preoccupation is here in the context of animal breeders. The Gemara doesn't say that about a man and a woman, in this case a non-Jewish employer with his Jewish employees, that Bavratayu Torit doesn't exist. It's the pure creative mind of Rabbi David Ibn Zimmer 5 centuries ago in Cairo. But we're going to see soon how much of an impact this is going to have on the world of Pesach.
Can I just give you
please?
Just a thing about it. Gemara in Ksuvah, Chof Gimel, or whatever, talks about a captive, the case of the captive.
A Shvuya.
And we say she's mother.
Well, there's machlokas tanoim about that. I don't know the final conclusion. I don't know who we paskin. I'd have to open up the Rambam and Hilchos Isurim Bia for that.
We could have used that as a Kal Vachomer. Instead of having to do this, we were saying that she's mutter, according to one man, the Omar, she'd be mutter, therefore Allah is kama v'kama.
Right, but nobody there in Ksuvis in Shvuya is going to advocate allowing this to go on. In other words, in the context of Yichud, no one's going to say that we find from Shvuya that you can find some sort of leniency, whether it be lechatchila, b'dieved, you know, post facto. It's not even a sniff. Here you find Bavarotayu Torit. So here's where you have a little bit of a gap, and the Radbaz is willing to jump across that gap. The Gemara is talking about Bavarotayu Torit in the context of animal breeders. The Radbaz is allowing himself the license to go one step further and say that men and women who are working together, that's also Bavarotayu Torit. Again, is that enough for him to be matir? Absolutely not. He calls it preaches. But he calls it a sniff. And it's a very important sniff because, again, if we can add together A, B, C, and D and put it all in the mixer, then in the case of a woman who needs this desperately for the sake of Parnasa, then we can use what I called before Koch Tetera Adif. But take a look at the next line in the Radbaz. This, I think, is even more revolutionary. And again, it's going to have a tremendous impact on Pesach. He says, Vesu, furthermore, Kevan di osim malacha zu heim bale umnus. The employer owns this geschäft. You know, this is the way that he makes money. You know, the women are working today. The women are working as with computers and so secretaries or whatever. But back in the day, they were working whatever business that they were there. In other words, they couldn't find men to do this malach, or at least not at that price. So they desperately need the women. And here are the key words. Lomari lichezkasayu. They will not ruin their reputation. Chezkasayu means there's a certain accepted behavior pattern. And if you violate that behavior pattern, then you might just lose all your ability to find women who are willing to work with you. In other words, it's not worth it for him, just for the sake of enjoying the pleasure of the moment, to jeopardize his ability, his status and reputation for the sake, you know, and that might mean repercussions, so that would mean that he can't find women to work for him. Once again, where did the Radbaz get this from? And how does he know that it applies in the context of Yichud? So the first question I think I can answer. This is also Gemara Navodah Zarah, but here we have to fast forward 20 pages, from page 20 to page 40. You'll see it on the bottom. And the Encyclopedia Talmudit makes a big deal about this. And the question is, can we rely on a non-Jew to tell us that this is kosher? Yeah.
Whose reputation? Is the woman's reputation?
No. I'm sorry if I was unclear. Let me start again. We're talking about the employer's reputation. In other words, if he makes advances towards this woman, what's it going to mean in terms of his ability to go back to the same community and hire women to work for him? No one's going to want to work for him. He's a no good schlub, you know what I'm saying? I'm not going to use all the adjectives in the world. You'll feel that in yourself. That's called an uman lo mare umanasayahu. He has a chazakah, he has a reputation, he doesn't want to jeopardize that reputation. That inhibits him in terms of the passion that might lead him to do such an action. So again, as I ask you the question, where did the Radbaz get this from? So what I'm suggesting is the Gemara of Rav. The cases what we call today, I think, caviar, if I'm not mistaken. You know, these are eggs of fish. You can't see the simonim on the caviar, so you don't know which fish it came from. And it's not always apparent and obvious to the eye. And yet Rav says that we're allowed to take and purchase these beitzei dogim from a mumcha, meaning a mumcha who knows how to determine what fish it came from. So if he tells you that this came from a tuna fish or a salmon or whatever kosher fish it is, you can rely on him. That's the question. Is he Jewish or is he not Jewish? So the Encyclopedia Talmudit, which I used here, under an erech called Chazakah, has a long discussion about this. And in the first opinion, which you'll see, he notes it in number 86, is the Levush or so. Anyway, he says that Chazok ein uman mishaker, if he's selling you something and you might catch him on a lie, so that means he misrepresents his product, then there's a chazokah. Now the word chazokah in this context means what we call circumstantial evidence, statistical probability. So even though he's a non-Jew, according to this opinion, we can rely on him. Why? Because if we find out that he's lying, and it's very easy to check that out, then he'll lose his business. He'll be fired. We'll soon see that Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to use this, again, not today, but that's for next week, in a kashrus issue about Chol of Akum. That if you how do you know he's not mixing in giraffe's milk or swine or whatever it might be? So the answer is, uman lomare umenu sayur. But nobody, until the Radbaz, ever took that out of the context of kashrus laws, and by analogy applied it to the case of Yichud, of a man alone with a woman, and she has to worry about the possibility of some sort of relationship being engendered here. And the answer is no. He's not going to do that. Why? Because it will affect his reputation in a bad way. Oh, okay, excellent. So Lamaisa, again, I'm jumping a little bit ahead of myself, but ladies, you made the point that the poskim will not rely on this. On this particular sniff, as we called it, to be matir, a woman being alone with a man in a place of work. Because it's hard to say why. I mean, I'm going to give you my possibility. Either they thought that the equation of the Radbaz is imprecise, and his analogy doesn't hold, or alternatively, because of the promiscuous society in which we live, and the facts, and it's all on the table, and you just read it in the news or wherever. They don't even bother publicizing it anymore. But because of this, I think the situation is not the same. But what I do want to tell you, that although, and I can't emphasize this enough, although with regard to a Jewish woman working with non-Jews, we will not rely on these two pieces of logic to justify and find a leniency, we're going to have to rely either on Pesach Pasuk Lushus Harabim, which means that anyone can enter at any time if it's not locked and so on, or on the fact that her husband is within the city limits. If she's married, that's not going to help us for a non-married girl. We will not rely on the Radbaz as far as the working woman is concerned. But what I'm going to try to spend a couple of minutes is to show you in other contexts how much we do rely on this Radbaz and how much we will accept his analogies and his logic in other cases. Okay, so let me take out my notes here, and I want to go kiss Seder. Here's the issue. One of the most profound issues in the laws of Yichud is an examination by a physician. Again, if a woman could be checked out by a female, you know, gynecologist, that's fine. Tavol el bracha. But, you know, if you live out in wherever, you know, if you're not in a major urban city, the chances of finding the right physician, and she being a female, it might be a little bit lower. You know, again, there are many female gynecologists. Some of the best gynecologists in Jerusalem here, where we are female. But given the reality that there is no option, a woman needs to be checked. And here, the question is very profound. Let's put the cards on the table. We've got on one side refuah, we have health. A woman needs to be examined. On the other hand, we have yichud, and I'll tell you why. It's almost by definition mutually exclusive. Because of kavod abrios. Kavod abrios means that human dignity requires that such an examination be performed in privacy. The last thing in the world a person wants is to be exposed at that point. Privacy is built into the nature of this examination, but privacy by definition is yichud. Are you with me on this? How severe is the halachic problem? It's almost like eimanos, you know, there's no way out. There's no possibility here. How can we allow a violation of the issur yichud? Again, if it's pikuach nefesh, we have a rule of pikuach nefesh. Even that's complicated. And this has to do with the Shoah and other historical moments in Jewish history. But let's assume, for argument's sake, that even if yichud is doraisa, according to many Rishonim, but nevertheless, it is not yehari val yavar. It's not a cardinal sin. But nevertheless, we're not talking about pikuach nefesh now. We're talking about a very important health examination that has to be done, whether a woman before birth, before pregnancy, or after, later in life, of about 50 million situations. I mean, gynecologists make a decent living, I hope. I don't know, in Kupat Cholim, I don't know. But then anyway, in America, I think. Any doctor hopefully makes it. You know, things are changing in America too. But given that the gynecologist is busy, it's because this examination is necessary. But by definition, we have a yichud problem. So the first major tshuva to come up with a cool on this in contemporary life was the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. And basically, his kula is based on what we call snifim. Again, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. And he comes up with the following possibilities, which I'll just mention a few of them. And he says the following. And again, nobody in this audience is going to be too thrilled about this, but this is what he says. Number one. And again, all of the following four possibilities that he offers are all based on the following premise that a medical examination does not require total privacy. What does that mean? Number one, the door of the examination room is closed but not locked. That alone, my friends, is not enough to allow yichud, because in this situation, no one is barging into that door. For all intents and purposes, the door is locked, if you follow my point. However, he says, if there are three people in the waiting room or one married couple, he's going to allow it. Number two, even if the door is locked, if the key is in the hands of somewhere, someone, anywhere in the city, who can open the door at any time. The third possibility is the husband of the woman being examined is in the city. Not clear whether he would allow that if the door is locked. And the husband clearly doesn't have a key. Number four, the doctor's office is located in one of the rooms of his residence, which means that any of the members of his family, including his own wife, has access to that room. Okay. Now, I have to tell you that with all due respect to Rav Waldenberg, I understand everything that he's saying, but, you know, it's tough, you know, to organize and orchestrate that any of these four conditions to exist. I mean, imagine if the husband is not in the city, again, if the door is locked, and no one has a key, you know, to guarantee that someone is in the key, the people in the waiting room. Again, all this is great, you know, and thank from Voldemort for coming up with this cooler, because he's trying to wiggle out of almost an impossible situation. But it's still a little bit what I call a shasat chak, you know. So what I want to quote to you now is another line in his tshuva. And this line caught the attention of many other poskim who came up with much more lenient answers to this question of yichud in a physical examination. And they said that here we can apply the two principles of the Radbaz. Number one, b'afad tayu torid, and number two, chazok al uman delo marim nesayu. Why? Because number one, he's involved in his work. You know, he's a physician. And he's not thinking about other things. And number two, he will not jeopardize his reputation if he does something illegal. Now, some of the poskim later on, Reb Chaim Scheinberg and Reb Leib Trapa in a book called Yichud, they're not happy about this, especially, you know, the reputation issue of Chazok al Uman, because they say that today things are topsy-turvy. And as far as Baba Tayu Tori, they claim that the facts on the ground don't bear this out. But what I want to leave you with here is that those poskim who are lenient, based on the tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, will add the logic of the Radbaz. Number three, so we have yichud in the working place, then we have yichud in the physician's office, and now number three, we have the issue of yichud in an automobile, a man and a woman. Let's take the case of a date, right? He's taking her out on a date, and he has a car. You know, in my days, you know, you could use the train, but, you know, sometimes that was a strike against you, you know, if you didn't have a car, you know. So, you know, I once borrowed a car to take a girl out on a date, and the first thing she says is, "This car smells." It's my father's old LeSabre. It was an Alta Toronto. Anyway, so the poskim here basically are split into two. Those poskim are more lenient. They say, well, he's driving down a road, there are other cars, you know, they don't block out the windows, so it's called Pesach Pasuch Lushus Arab, and it's not a yichud problem. However, there's a tshuvah written by the Taras Yontif that had a tremendous impact, Rav Yosef Grunwald, in which he comes to the conclusion that you might think there are other cars on the road, but that's not always guaranteed. For example, he says, at night, even if there are cars on the road, they can't see what's going on inside the automobile. Number two, he says, and even during the day, if you're traveling through a deserted area, you don't expect anyone to go by. And I remember I had a Talmud of mine who was taking a girl out, I think she was in Muncie, New York. Anyway, they had a private home, and there was like a long driveway in front of the home. And what they would do is, this was classic, they would come back at the wee hours of the morning, and they would sit in the car and schmooze. I mean, I'm assuming that's all they were doing was schmoozing, right? And it was 3 in the morning, and they were off the road. You know, so even if there were cars on the road, but they were, you know, they were up the alleyway. Again, if the parents were smart, they were looking out the window. But let's say that didn't happen. So I always tell my students, they laugh at me, I say daytime dating is preferable if you have an automobile. But even daytime dating is not simple. So here we have a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, in which he writes, the question was a woman who had to go to mikvah. She's a married woman. She has to go to mikvah. And there's no mikvah in town. She has to take a special driver, you know, hire a driver. Her husband can't drive her. He's watching the kids or whatever it is. And the driver's going to take her to the mikvah. So Rav Moshe says that in this case, although again Rav Moshe is machmir in all cases of yichud in automobile, he's even more machmir than Taras Yontif on this issue. But in the case of a taxi driver, he says that maybe for the sake of mikvah, we have to be mekil. And the only way we can do this, how is a taxi driver different than a date that we talked about before, is because of the radas. Because number one, the taxi driver is bavo d'tayu torid, you know, he's got to drive the car. And number two, chazak al uma delo marian usayu, because his reputation is at stake. You can imagine what happens if he, you know, drives the car off the road and does what he does, and then that's it. Again, we see that the tshuva of the Radbaz was a breakthrough tshuva. And finally, the issue of yichud in an elevator. Again, split amongst the poskim. A man or a woman are going up an elevator alone, and the machmirim claim that this is not called Pesach Pasuch L'Shisarab, because Pesach Pasuch L'Shisarab means that the door is open, anyone who passes by at any moment could come in. But in the case of an elevator, when it goes from one floor to the other, and lo me boy, I don't even want to tell you about an express elevator. I think in my youth there was the Empire State Building had an elevator that went up, I think, 60 floors in one shot. You know, other poskim say that when it comes to the shear of yichud, how long of a time period is there a violation of a woman and a man alone? And a different sheet is on this, but let's assume, and according to the Dvar Halacha, which is Rav Avraham Horowitz, one of the great poskim on yichud, he writes a chatzi shear asur min haTorah. Which means that even if I'm not, you know, my violation of, let's say, of chazer is only when I eat a kazayis, but if I eat a chatzitzayis, we paskin that that's also minatoros. Machlokes from Yochanan Reish Lakish at the end of Yuma. If that be the case of chatzishir is also minatoros, then in case of an elevator, so the Mekilim say, well, it's not even chatzishir because every second it stops and somebody comes into the elevator, so it's not even a chatzishir. But other poskim say it's a chatzishir. So I have one interesting tshuva here from the Dvar Halacha, in which he talks about a woman going into an elevator and there's an elevator operator. Like, for example, in fancy buildings, you'll still see all over the world, but I know in Manhattan you'll see this on Fifth Avenue. You know, there is still, what do they call it? We'll call it the elevator operator for the time being. If you have a better word, you'll let me know. And he wants to come up with a tshuva, a heter, based on the Radbaz, that he says the elevator operator is, number one, involved in his work, and therefore he's not focused on that. And number two, the fact that uman lo mare uman osai, because again, if he gets... So I'm just trying to leave you with the following, just to summarize whatever we've been discussing here in the last half hour. Number one, the Radbaz has a brilliant but very scary kind of analogy in which he takes two principles in two different sugyas and he applies them to yichud, and one could argue that that's a leap of faith, and number two, that he himself doesn't rely on it to be matir, a working woman, and none of the poskim rely on it, but in other cases, and we gave four different situations in which the poskim will rely on the Radbaz and actually issue a lenient ruling. So let's just go over the four cases. Number one, yichud and the physician. Number two, yichud in the automobile. And yichud in the elevator. And in all cases, we're dealing with uman lo mari uman asai. Now I want to talk to you about adoption. We're talking about family life. What about adoption? The Gemara says that anyone who raises the child of someone else, an orphan, is malal of akosu ki liyoldo. It's like fulfilling the mitzvah piri v'rivya. There was a tshuva of the Ram Shik about 100 someone years ago, in which he writes that if a childless couple never should adopt a child, then it's like a miktas kiyum. It's almost a fulfillment of the mitzvah piri v'rivya, because malal of akosu ki liyoldo. What about yichud? Imagine a couple adopts a young girl. She's not related to her adoptive father. Are they never going to be alone together? That's impossible. A couple adopts a young boy. Now, the Issa Yichud with a boy only starts when he's 9 years old. Okay, so she's raising this child as her own. He's 9 years old. What does it mean? Does it mean that every time the door closes, you know, she has to fly out of there or something? Like, it's impossible. You basically close the door on adoption. The whole institution of adoption goes down the tubes. Now, there's a great work that has 20 volumes called the Otzer HaPoskim, which is a collection of psak. In one of the volumes that's dedicated exclusively to Yichud, a volume this thick, there's an introduction from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichron Levracha. And the Rebbe says that it's Otzer. That you can only adopt a child either at a very young age for a limited time, but once the child is included in Yichud, a girl is 3, the boy is 9, there's no heter for them to be alone. Some say, I don't know, I can't vouch for this, that that's why the Rebbe never adopted a child. I can't tell you that's true. But I can tell you that he wrote the tshuva. And if you're interested, we'll go through the tshuva inside. No leniency whatsoever. So here's a case where we need a landmark, heroic tshuva. And this we have from two, I call them contemporary poskim, they're gone already, but not long ago. Again, the Tzitz Eliezer that I mentioned earlier, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, and Rav David Halevi amongst the Sfaradim, he was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, in his book called Aseh Lecha Rav. In the Tzitz Eliezer, he argues that there's no yichud in this case. Why? And he says the following. We have to understand why there's no yichud between biological parents and their biological children, and that goes all generations, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so forth. Why? So you and I could say, well, that's because this comes under the Gemara in Bava Kamma that says, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, what was Spala, they prayed to destroy to undermine and neutralize the fantastically powerful Yetzirah for incest. We don't know of that Yetzirah today, although unfortunately we live in a world that seems to have gone to the pre-Anshei Knesset HaGedolah period. But let's assume that for the most part there's no taiva, there's no lust, and there's no alluring power of the evil inclination with regard to biological relatives. Comes along to Tzitz Eliezer and he says the same thing applies to adoptive parents. Pella, I mean, that's not a biological parent. In all laws, adoption does not substitute for biological parents. Let's say, for example, Yerusha. If, let's say, a couple has a biological child of their own, and they have an adoptive child, according to the laws of Yerusha, again, you could change Yerusha, but for that you need a contract. But other than that, in the absence of any contract, according to Jewish law, all the inheritance goes, the estate goes to the biological child. And I can give you 50 other examples. So what is the status of an adoptive child in Halacha? Pretty much zero. There is no status. Comes along Rabbi Elazar Waldenberg, and he says that with regard to Yichud, there is a status. That parents who raise a child as their own have the same status as biological parents, and there's no Yetzirah. A leap of faith. And Rav David Halevi accepted that psak for Sfaradim, hence there's a possibility of adopting a child. Otherwise, we're back to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which means, I don't know, how you can adopt a child? I was told, I can't vouch for this, that my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik also was Mekil, and he allowed Yichud in the case of adoptive parents. But he, and you'll find the fledglings of this also in Rav Waldenberg, they had certain conditions. Rav Waldenberg, for example, insists that the adoption takes place before the time of the Isur Yichud, meaning that the girl is less than 3 and the boy is less than 9. Otherwise, he admits that there's an Isur Yichud, because you can't start this kind of relationship when there already is an Isur Yichud. So you can only build this relationship when there is no Yichud, when there's no Isur Yichud, there's no Erevah, there's no relationship of a possible Bia. So let's just summarize, because we're going to have to end in about 6 minutes, that what we've said until now, that within the structure of family, and in terms of the laws of Yichud, we have a breakthrough tshuva of the Radbaz that could help us in many, many different cases, and the poskim will fall back on the Radbaz, even though his analogy is, as I called it, a leap of faith. And we have a breakthrough tshuva of two tshuvas, of two rabbonim, contemporary tshuvas, with regard to Yichud in the case of adoption. I bring this to your attention because I think it is a very good introduction to the series that we're embarking upon about major landmark heroic tshuvas. And these tshuvas are all tshuvas that had a tremendous impact on Jewish history, and they continue to do so. From family, I want to talk about civil marriage, because that also relates to family. I'll tell you how. Imagine a couple that's civilly married, a Jewish couple. He's Jewish, she's Jewish. So that halachically, if they're married, she can only get out of that marriage according to the halacha with a get. If she's an Eishes Ish, if there's issues, if there's a relationship between he and her, there was no chuppah of a kedushin. You and I would say, well, if there's no chuppah of a kedushin, they're not married. They're living together out of wedlock. She doesn't need a get. If she goes ahead and has a relationship with another man, the child of that marriage is not a mamzer. It's tremendous issues over here. There's no chuppah of a kedushin. The problem is that there are three ways of marrying a woman. And the last way is called bia. And we have a principle called hein hein eidi yichud, hein hein eidi bia. If it's public knowledge that a man and a woman are living together as husband and wife, that itself constitutes eidus. And this has repercussions in the laws of sota and so forth and so on. Not only that, but we have a Gemara in a few places in Shas that says, Chazaka al Adam Yisrael She'eno Ose Bilaso Bilas Nus, that he doesn't live in a wanton relationship out of wedlock. So if he is living with this woman, then he is living with her as his wife, and he has in mind Kiddushei Bia. So you'll tell me, well, he and she stood in front of a justice of the peace, or whatever it's called, and they signed the document, and they pledged allegiance to the civil marriage. Where are the witnesses? We need kosher witnesses. But the answer is, if they're living together, and it's public knowledge, as husband and wife, we have witnesses. So if we combine A plus B, we're in deep trouble here with civil marriage. And this is going to be the major breakthrough of Rav Henkin, Zichrono Livracha, that we should combine two principles. The principle of Hein Hein Eidi Yichud, Hein Hein Eidi Bia, which means that there are witnesses here, because it's public knowledge. And number two, that a man doesn't make his Be'ila into a Be'ila's Nus. 6 centuries ago, there was a Sephardic posek, a tremendous Gadol B'Yisrael. He's at that period of transition between the Rishonim and the Achronim. Some call him a Rishon, some call him an Achron, but he's before the Beit Yosef, so he's technically a Rishon. His name was the Rivash. The Rivash wrote prolific tshuvas. And in one tshuva, he addresses the case of a couple during the Spanish Inquisition that were baptized, the Jewish couple. They accepted Christianity, and they were married in a church, a Jewish couple. Again, you know, the Christians considered them to have been converts to Christianity. Well, later on, somehow, they were able to escape the Inquisition, and they showed up in front of the Rivash, and the question was, does she need a get? He wanted to go his way, she wanted to go her way. They were married in a church, as Christians. And the Rivash allowed her to get married without a get. He said, this is not a marriage. And then he asks himself the following question, and hopefully next week we'll go through parts of the tshuva inside, because this is a really landmark tshuva. And he says, and if you'll ask me, Chazak al Adam She'enos Oseh Bilaseh Bilas Nus, he says that they were living as Christians, and therefore this principle doesn't apply to them. It only applies to people who are living in a marriage relationship as husband and wife under Jewish law. They were not living as husband and wife under Jewish law. They were living as Christians. And what the Rivash is doing here is very sensational, because who cares whether they're living as Christians or they are Jews. And the Gemara applies this rule, this absolute rule of Chazakah, to Jews. And the later poskim are going to be so reliant on the Rivash that they can even apply it to the case of civil marriage. Now, civil marriage is not a couple that were married in the church and were baptized and were accepted another religion. These are Jews who are simply ignorant. They don't know anything about Judaism. They may not even be interested at this point in their life in Judaism, but nevertheless, they went for a marriage relationship, and they're living as husband and wife.
And what if they cheat?
That's an interesting question, because again, are we going to see, your question is the following: how does the halacha work? How do the poskim operate? Are they going to take every single couple, you know, under advisement and investigate, are they really loyal to each other, are they committed to each other, husband and wife? And maybe, you know, Hallie and Sally fit into one category, but Reuven and Leah fit into another category. I mean, Ein L'Davar Sof. Does it mean that every single case we have to check their tzitzis? Or can we say, look, the fact that they got married in a civil marriage, that itself means they're outside of the religious law, and therefore it's not considered a marriage relationship? And here's where the poskim want to rely on this tshuva, the Rivash, that Polinetta will go through next time, and say that, you know, civil marriage is not a marriage at all, and chazaka, etc., doesn't apply in this case. And that's where we have another landmark tshuva from Rav Henkin. And Rav Henkin said that there are many reasons why a Jewish couple might not have gone for a Jewish chuppah of a kiddushin, not the least of which is total ignorance. But they would like to be recognized as husband and wife according to all legal systems. They are Jews. They were born Jews. They did not convert to another religion. And they don't know any better. And therefore, this might be a recognized, you know, Jewish marriage relationship. So we'll pick that up, God willing, next time. I want to thank everyone for coming. And if you're interested in this kind of a structure, I'm all excited about it. Because to show you that certain shuvas throughout Jewish history had a tremendous impact on the future of halacha.
So listen, I'm from Danville, Virginia, a small town. We had a lot of interesting rabbis. And we had one rabbi that we thought was extreme. There were maybe four or five of us in our Hebrew school class, one was a girl. And he said we needed to go learn in the car, not in the shul, because we were four girls and him. We used to have our Hebrew school classes twice a day in the car.
Because it was public view. It was, if you sat in the car and then you didn't tint the windows, there were no curtains on the windows, then anyone walking by, the public could see it.
But no other rabbi did that.
The other rabbis probably assumed that the school is unlocked and if anyone could come into the school. That would have been, I think, more the, you know, the normative halakha.
Thank you very much. I have a regular shiur that I go to Sunday morning, which I think I'm not coming to
class. Okay. Well, and today there was no such class? Or,
what?
They canceled the class, but today that you were able to come.
She's not here today.
She's not here.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Point of information.
I put my shiurim up on YU Torah, so if you give me your email, I'll send you a link.
YU Torah, I'll look up.
Yeah, Azaria Berzon.
Thank you. Quick one. Rabbi White told me with my non-biological grandson, when I go to sleep, I should tell him, while we were eating, there were other boys there, to leave the door open. And you couldn't see it into the hallway. When I go to sleep, to tell him to close the door, I should go into my bedroom first, close my door. That was his tshuva. Number two, with the situation today, almost every doctor, male, examining a female patient has his nurse in the office.
Oh, that's something else. If there is, require...
You know, you could see how the current situation has changed even the necessity for halakha.
Right.
I had a...
That she can enter into the room at any time during the examination.
No, they have them stay there.
Oh, they're in the room.
They're in the room. I don't... I
didn't know women would be happy.
With the biological organization or a vaginal... But if I go to my doctor... And he's just, you know, checking my blood pressure or something, and I'm dressed. Is that yichud also? Or is it when it's a...
Right, that kind of situation, like a gynecological... Can I assume that the door is unlocked? I mean, I would think...
No, he closes the door. He doesn't lock it. The nurse is right
so
outside.
So, again, you know, there are people outside in the waiting room. There could be a problem if no one's outside and he locks the door.
No, the nurse is there, whatever. Right. Anyway, Rabbi Wein said, given what was happening with rabbis and... women parishioners, says any rabbi who's in a room alone with a woman is crazy.
Oh, thanks.
He comes right to the point,
right,
you know,
to the point.
Because every